Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're pleased to have back here on the show after some time off, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois. And for some time now, he's been stopping by once a month to do a program on personal finance, to talk about financial planning and investment strategies. And the way we do this is that he usually begins by making a few comments. And then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with investing, money management, I know he would do his best to help you out. And we do have a guest this morning he brought along. He will introduce that. We'll give him an opportunity to talk about a topic very current and timely when it comes to the financial markets. So we welcome back. Hi, Dave. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you and certainly fun to be back as well. First, I intend to quickly review the stock market and the year-to-date results of our couch potato portfolio. And secondly, as you just mentioned, I have an invited guest, Mr. Frank Balin, who is partner in Revere Mortgage Company, locally in Champaign-Urbana, with offices also in the greater metropolitan Chicago area and well-known as a mortgage broker in the area, to discuss, well, that funny concept called subprime mortgages, whatever that means, and the crisis and its obvious impact on our stock markets. I might also add that Mr. Balin holds a PhD in finance from Loyola University. All right, let me give you a quick overview of the markets and more particularly the stock market, because that's really where the hot action has been. Now, just a month ago, our couch potato portfolio, for those of you who have been following it under links on WILL, was up, well, 9.27% for the year, inclusive of dividends. Through yesterday's close, our portfolio was down 0.8% for the year. In fact, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has dropped some 8.5% from its highs of over 14,000, and the S&P 500 has dropped some 8.6% from its high of 1545 on the S&Ps. In fact, the past 3 to 4 weeks, let's admit it, it's just been brutal on stock market investors. Nevertheless, as I've articulated countless times on this program in the past, you've got to take a long-term view. You have to be properly diversified if you are going to be in the financial markets. So you have to have short-term fixed income. You have to have basics, money markets, savings accounts, etc. And then to the extent that you are going to invest in equities, you must take a long-term view. Otherwise, short-run volatility, just like the volatility that we've seen over the last 3 to 4 weeks, well, it's going to eat you up. And you're going to sell precisely at the wrong times when you probably should be focusing on the bigger picture and long-run returns. So, for example, if we simply look at our indexes through a 5-year time window, and admittedly that's really not long enough, here are the annual returns investors have enjoyed, including the last month, year-to-date, and through the last 5 years. So if you'd been in the S&P 500 over the last 60 consecutive months, you would have enjoyed compounded annualized returns of 12%. Large value index, 15%. Small cap companies, about 17%. Real estate investment trusts, which have just been hammered this year, still over the last 5 years up some 17% annually on a compounding basis. The international assets, even more so on fire. The total international index up some 33%. We heard just this morning on NPR News that Tokyo, the Nikkei, that international markets have dropped precipitously again today. But when we think about it over a 5-year window, they've been up dramatically. Emerging markets up some 20% plus on a compounded basis over the last 5 years. So in light of what I would call relatively spectacular returns over the last 5 years, our negative 8 to 10% over the last month really pales by comparison. So while no one can predict when the damage is over, we do know that approximately once in every 4 years, we typically have a negative stock market. And that negative stock market is about a negative 14%. So once every 4 years, you've got to prepare yourself for a down market. If we go back to the beginnings of the stock market and we just say how many years are up, how many years are down, you can figure that about at least 25% of the time that you're going to have a down market. So is this surprising? Well, it's painful. But is it surprising? No, it should not be surprising to anyone. And indeed, even as much damage has occurred in the last 4 weeks, our couch potato portfolio, which of course consists of these different international and U.S. indexes, well, it's basically delta neutral. It's almost even. Okay, so what in the world is going on, especially in this last month, to provoke this kind of volatility that we've experienced in the stock market? And even today, we learned that the Federal Reserve got together and dropped the rates by 0.5%. The Fed funds rate basically has now dropped from essentially 5.25 to 4.75. The discount rate looks like that's dropped from 6.25 to 5.75. What in the world is going on? And apparently it revolves around this concept of subprime mortgage lending, its impact on the housing market, the impact on the economy in general. So enter our resident expert, Mr. Balin. And Mr. Balin, tell us, let's start with the basics. What in the world is a subprime mortgage? And I should say, thanks for coming.
My pleasure, Dave. Basically, a subprime mortgage is a mortgage made to individuals that are high risk. High risk meaning credit issues. Bad credit or credit that doesn't qualify for a traditional mortgage through the major governmental agencies that provide such financing, which is Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and VA and FHA-type lending, rural development as such.
Okay, so if I'm just the normal vanilla borrower and I come to you or any of the other fine mortgage companies in the area and say, you know, I bought a house, I need an 80% conventional loan, I have a decent credit score, I'm going to get a typical conventional mortgage, not a subprime mortgage.
That's correct, Dave. You will be getting a traditional conventional mortgage.
And I would provide you with – you would call up my credit score history. What would I be required to provide you with so I'm not in this subprime area?
They look at basically a couple of things for what we call a full documentation loan. They'll be looking at your credit history and they'll be looking at your income to see if you would qualify.
Okay. So – that's a conventional loan. Now, conventional loans really aren't in trouble. That's not what's driving the market here.
That is correct. It is not in trouble.
Okay. So tell us about maybe default rates of subprime mortgages compared to conventional mortgages.
Right now, the subprime default rates are hovering around 15 to 16%. And traditional mortgages, Fannie Mae, are around 3%. So you can see there's a vast differences.
Okay. Well, so anyone who has, of every 100 subprime mortgages, in other words, about 15% of those or 15 people are defaulting.
Are either in default or in foreclosure.
Or in foreclosure. And, okay, so I understand that. So that sounds like bad news if I'm a borrower. How did this happen to these borrowers? What was going on why they can't make their payments, for example? What in the world's going on here?
Typically, people who are involved in subprime mortgages are in an ARM product. The ARM products traditionally are priced higher than a traditional ARM, say, with good credit. And these people, for example, that for paying maybe 9.5% 2 or 3 years ago, or maybe even higher, their loan adjusted after 2 years, like probably around 2%, so now they're paying 11%. Typically, these borrowers had a very difficult time even paying, say, 9 or 9.5%. And when it went to 11, it blew them out of the box. So then they are delinquent and in the midst of a lot of them in foreclosure.
So these ARMs are adjustable rate mortgages, and they adjust either at the end of 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, et cetera. And they can move in that adjustment period, what, 2%?
Usually 2%.
2% annually and up to 6% over the life of a loan. So maybe these people in a subprime mortgage started with a loan, you're saying, at 9%, while other people were maybe in the sixes or fives.
Even lower,
and,
yes.
And lower in a conventional loan. Were these loans typically 90% finance loans, 100% finance loans? What typically were these loans at?
Well, it's, even the subprime is on a sliding scale, but a lot of them were made 90, 95, and believe it or not, some even 100% loans.
Okay. So I've got a 100% subprime loan. I started out at 9, which was ungodly high to begin with. Now I'm at 11, and because of people not paying their loans, people having so many houses on the market, and the price of housing actually dropping, are we basically upside down? Am I upside down in my loan? In other words, I owe more than my house is worth.
Well, That could happen. It affects a lot of things. But basically, these people could be upside down. In many cases, depending on the kind of subprime loan they had, they could maybe in some cases be owing more money than their original loan amount, because a lot of times the lenders, what they would do if you were in delinquent or defaulting is they would give you a break in terms of letting you defer your payment when they add the payment onto the end of the mortgage. So if you started with a $100,000 mortgage and then maybe 2 years later you could be maybe in $108,000, $109,000, and obviously housing itself is in a kind of a depressed state. So you're correct. You could definitely be upside down.
So then what happens? All right. So I'm upside down. I'm a subprime borrower. And I said, I'm going to capitulate. That's it. Here. Take my property. That's basically what's happening, or it's going into foreclosure.
That's correct.
Okay, now, all right, I understand that. So for a borrower, it's obviously bad news. It affects their credit. They maybe have to go into bankruptcy. There's all kinds of issues. But how does it affect the lender, and why is it affecting these financial markets? Who are the other players that are getting impacted here?
In addition to the traditional lending, which we talked about, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and et cetera, you have these pooled funds. They're hedge funds and other funds that invest in collateralized mortgage obligations. And these funds are made available to mortgage banks. Some you've heard of recently in the paper, like Countrywide and a number of others that provide that type of financing for subprime borrowers.
Okay, so we have these things called hedge funds. That's one example.
Correct.
And hedge funds loan money, or do they simply buy loans?
They buy loans.
All right, so a mortgage broker makes a subprime loan, and that loan ultimately ends up in this hedge fund?
That's correct. They make they maybe use a Countrywide or Bank of America or some of these lenders that specialize in this kind of paper. This paper is ultimately sold off to a Bear Stearns or Goldman Sachs that goes into their hedge funds, and they're the ones that are that have the paper.
Okay, so like Bear Stearns, for example, had literally billions of dollars of this paper.
Correct.
And apparently it just almost became worthless.
It dropped significantly enough that they had to recapitalize those funds.
Yeah, it was several billions of dollars that had to be infused into that portfolio.
I think recently it was like $3 billion, I think, in the paper in the last few days, last week,
okay.
I think.
Well, how big is this subprime mortgage market? Does anyone really have a handle on how many billions of dollars are at risk? Are we talking hundreds of billions?
Relatively, in terms of the total marketplace, it's fairly, really small. I mean, I don't think it's more than maybe 10 to 15%, if it's that high. I can't say for sure, but it's around that. So it's not – I mean, it's large, but in the overall scheme of things, it's a small portion of the total residential mortgage market.
Okay. So part of this reaction has to be emotional.
Absolutely.
Because if it's a small percentage of the total mortgages that are out there, then it seems to me that this is not rational behavior.
You're right. Some is irrational behavior. But what happens is that the lenders start thinking to themselves, well, if this can happen subprime, this might be – we may not know other things. So you see a tightening in the market, in the credit markets, and tightening of requirements to get even conventional mortgages. And they pull in their horns, and it makes borrowing more difficult, which makes people buying houses harder to buy a house, et cetera, and it kind of affects the whole marketplace.
So when credit – tightens up, obviously it's more difficult to finance a house, so you can buy less house, which means that if I have a big expensive house that I want to sell, I may have to reduce my price.
Correct.
So that I can find more people who are qualified to be able to borrow to buy my house, and that's depressing prices all over the country.
That is correct, Dave.
Okay. Now, tell us about the local market. Compare the number of houses on the market here even as compared – you told me this. I was shocked at this statistic as compared to a year ago.
Well, I believe from the last time I looked, there are around 1,700 houses on the marketplace in this area. I think comparable maybe last year, I think we had maybe 500 or 600. So it is a dramatic oversupply of houses on the market today.
So it's truly a buyer's market.
Correct.
So one can negotiate. All right. So the subprime market – is not this gigantic, gigantic part of the mortgage market. Most people get conventional financing,
yes,
which ultimately involves Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, et cetera.
That's correct.
And what is the maximum limit on those kinds of loans to get conventional financing?
Fannie Mae, I believe, is $417,600 is the what we consider conventional financing in Fannie and Freddie.
Okay. So in other words, that's like buying really a $450,000 to $500,000 property, and most properties are not $450,000 to $500,000.
Right.
So most people are still getting conventional loans.
Correct.
And those conventional loans could be 80% loans, 85%, 90% loans, 100. For example. They can even be 100% conventional
100,
loans.
Yes.
And when we talk about a conventional loan then, we're talking about reasonable interest rates.
That's correct. Very reasonable rate.
And what are rates doing currently in the conventional mortgage arena, for example?
As of yesterday, before I came to this show, I didn't have a chance to look at the rates in detail. But, for example, a 30-year fixed rate mortgage under $417,000 is around 6.625, in that range, 6.625. For a traditional 30-year fixed.
Okay. And that's no points.
That's
just
no
closing
points.
Costs.
Yeah,
okay. So that's still historically, while it's not as good as it was a year and a half
still
or two
terrific.
Years ago, it's pretty decent when you can borrow money for 30 years at 6.6.
That's correct.
That's a pretty good bet. All right. So if I am a great big mortgage company like Countrywide,
mm-hmm.
and Countrywide makes some of these subprime mortgages.
That's
it
right.
has an area that where it makes subprime mortgages. Does it essentially keep those in its own portfolio, or some of them you're saying they sell them off to, for example, hedge funds or other investors?
That's right. They may keep some of their own portfolio and sell some off to these large pooled funds or the so-called collateralized mortgage obligations, which I alluded to earlier.
Okay, because I noticed in the journal yesterday it was noted that Countrywide for the first time, which is one of the very, very large.
It is the largest.
Okay, it is the largest, had to draw on a line of credit
right.
itself, which is highly unusual. Why did it have to do that? What's it doing with that money?
Well, it's covering some of their losses, and it's also covering their loan commitments, which they ordinarily wouldn't be able to handle if they didn't borrow against that line.
Okay. So they've made literally hundreds of billions, if not billions of dollars of loan commitments to borrowers all over the country.
That's right.
And so they have to have liquidity to close on those loans.
That is right.
Okay. And then they may sell those loans off, or they may put them in their own portfolio, et cetera.
That's right.
Okay. Now, most banks, for example, that are mid-sized banks, are they in this business? They're really not. They just do conventional financing and then they sell these off, don't they?
That's correct. They may keep some of their own portfolio in traditional or sell it off directly to Fannie or Freddie or through large mortgage banks.
Okay. But most mid-sized banks, certainly in the state of Illinois and even in Champaign-Urbana, I would suspect they are making mortgages, but those mortgages aren't staying very long on their shelves.
That's right. They would sell them off and then maybe service the mortgages through their own bank.
Okay. And you are a mortgage broker. How is that different than a bank going to a bank and getting a loan and going to you and getting a loan? What's the difference?
Well, really, there is no difference. The advantage a lot of us brokers have is we're able to shop rates all over the United States. Sometimes the banks are regionalized and theirs is tied to a certain region. And the definition, which you didn't ask, what is a mortgage broker? A mortgage broker is a person that doesn't use its own money, but it uses other people's money, such as the large mortgage banks we alluded to earlier, Citibank, ABN AMRO, and those kind of banks. A bank, a mortgage bank or bank, is an entity that uses its own money to fund loans.
Okay, so the major difference is that you simply are getting the money from your underwriter and the bank.
From our correspondents, so that we have relationships. That's
okay.
correct.
Uh-huh. I understand. And the bank is using its own money to close the loan, but you're both selling off the loans.
That is right.
All right. And you may end up servicing the loans. I want to go back to this default rate again. You're saying 15% on subprime mortgages, 3% on conventional. Is that high conventionally? I mean, I don't know historically.
Actually,
what
that's pretty good. That's a bit lower, but the 3% is, I think, pretty acceptable margin.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is not really out of the ordinary
no.
or anything. Now, the Federal Reserve steps in today. They lower rates, probably discount rates, Fed funds rate by 0.5%, and they're trying to increase liquidity and make borrowing less expensive. Who needs to borrow less expensively besides us, obviously, but why do large institutions need to do this?
Well, they do that a lot of times so they can make loans themselves. Either they have it through their own funds through CDs, et cetera, which they may use for that, or they use other people's money, such as the Federal Home Loan Bank, or borrow among themselves or borrowing from the Fed.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you to crystal ball. I hate to crystal ball because I refuse to do it myself. What do you see happening in the short term and over the next 6 months in this subprime business and the markets, et cetera? Do you think this is going to calm down or get worse?
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, because traditionally what happens in the subprime, that all these mortgages don't go bad at the same time. They go bad over a period of time. So as subprime mortgages were made over the last couple of years at different times, it will go bad over different times. So I think we're probably in the beginning of something that could last maybe as much as a couple of years.
Okay. Is this a California problem? I mean, I keep hearing that most of these subprime mortgages, a lot of them were made in stretches in areas of the country where housing is so expensive, California, some in Florida, et cetera? Or is this basically a national issue?
I would say it's a national issue. It wasn't regional. Yeah, definitely a national issue.
Okay. Maybe more so in some of these states where people are buying these more expensive homes.
That's true.
Well, I certainly don't want to cut off people from calling in, David, but I just wanted to sort of get some background on what the nature of this is all about.
Sure, sure. Well, and if people want to ask questions about that or other sorts of things, the kinds of things that when Dave has been here before, we've talked about other kinds of investing and money management issues, give us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a question, and as you've explained, the situation here, we've gotten in the situation because there were lenders who approached potential buyers who might have found it impossible to qualify for a conventional loan. And the lender said to that person, I can make it possible for you to own your own home. Maybe even no money down, very reasonable payments. And so we got people into mortgages where either they could initially afford it, or maybe it might have been even a little bit tight for them. But they offered an attractive interest rate, or what seemed to be an attractive rate at the beginning. And that's the way it was for a while. But then the rate goes up, so you get to this point where suddenly people find that they can't make their monthly payments. So having said all that, for people who can qualify for a conventional loan, whose credit is good, does it ever make sense to get yourself into an adjustable rate mortgage? Or would you say, no, do not pay any attention to any deal like that someone's offering you? If it's a fantastic deal up front, if it's going to go up, it would be better for you to have a fixed rate and know that's what it's going to be and that's what it's always going to be.
Well, I guess you would say it's basically it's your tolerance for risk. If you're going to live in this house for maybe 3 or 5 years typically, then you may want to go to an adjustable rate mortgage in normal circumstances. Now, in this market, for example, your ARM rates, like your 5 and 7 year ARM, are really very close in terms of the interest rate as a 30-year fixed rate. And the reason for that is all these rates are tied to the Treasury yield, and usually it's tied to the 10-year Treasury. So the 10-year Treasury, for example, it's like, I didn't check 4.7, 4.8 in that range. Mm-hmm. I haven't checked today. Mm-hmm. And if you look at your 5 and 7 years, they're very close to that. So for today, for example, you would be usually getting a fixed rate because the rate's not going to be that much difference, and there's not enough savings to go with a 5 or 7 versus a 30-year fixed rate.
And for people who, you know, supposing you are in that situation, you're thinking, well, I'm just going to be in this property for a short period of time, a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So if it goes up after that, it's not my worry. So you get that kind of mortgage, and then your plans change, and then you decide that you are going to stay. Would there be difficulties in refinancing a loan like that and then getting yourself out of the old adjustable rate and getting into a fixed?
No. As long as you maintain halfway, you know, good credit and income, it's very simple.
Yeah, the only issue is what's the rate.
That's right. The issue would be what's the
rate. And you're absolutely right. Okay. What is your tolerance for risk? Do you want to take risk with the rate? And it differs for different people. I've done both, David. I'll be honest with you. I usually opt for fixed rates when I do mortgage financing, but sometimes I have had ARMs as well.
All right. Well, we got some callers here to talk with. Let's do that. And our guest, by the way, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and monthly he's here on a Friday. Once a month, we talk about personal finance. He's brought along as guest today Frank Balin from Revere Mortgage Company. They have offices here in Champaign-Urbana and also in Chicago, because he thought it'd be a good thing to talk a little bit about what this problem is in the lending market, the subprime problem, and how that's affected credit generally. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Whiteheath, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, I've heard a lot of stories about the problems that are happening in the mortgage business, and I haven't heard any talk about who is overseeing this whole mortgage lending business. Is there regulation besides the banking? I know there's banking regulations. Are there mortgage lending regulations? Are there laws to protect the whole industry, or is it like a sort of
let's say a fair.
Freewheeling game here?
Good question.
Well, it is. There are a couple of places. For example, the banks that do mortgage lending, they're obviously, for example, Illinois is governed by the Office of Banks and Real Estate that regulate banks and the kind of lending they do and requirements. But even more so on the national level, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are these entities that issue the paper, are also regulated, and they have certain regulations that they must meet and continue to meet in order to make these mortgages. So there is regulation. The issue happens to be when we talk about, again, we were talking earlier, non-governmental type mortgages.
Uh-huh.
And non-bank, we're talking about the high-risk type stuff I was talking about, these collateralized mortgage obligations and these pooled funds where the banks or the mortgage banks that take this on are guided by certain things. But the big issue with a lot of this is greed. There's a lot of them want to lend out as much as they can to make as much money as they can. So they were taking unnecessary risks in making these mortgages.
Well, do you think we need some regulation in that part of the business?
Oh, there's no question about that. There has to be something done here.
Do you think there'll be a push when Congress gets back to do something?
Well, I think
look at what the uproar in our economy now. I mean, it's crazy.
Yes, and the answer there is going to be right now. There is certain things done, even with these "quote unquote" subprime lenders that are making more restrictive, and they've cut back a lot of these programs to comply with this. Well, you know, it's the horse is out of the barn already, so
sure.
We have the issues. But going forward, there will be. And I think certain states are also making regulations. For example, one of the things they're doing is on the subprime, they used to make these mortgages, like in Illinois, for 2 years. And now they're saying if you make these ARM mortgages, they have to be at least 5 years, so some of that volatility is reduced.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right.
Sure.
Thanks. Well, let's go next to someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask maybe it's a crystal ball question, but I hope you can help me think through it. I hear a lot that it's a buyer's market, and there is an opportunity of a property in California for rental purpose. And do you see it as a wise thing to enter that market of buying something for rent at this point? And also, especially if it gives a negative. So I was looking at it as something that over time would might make up, you know, be a good investment. And the second question was, do you suggest that mortgage brokers to be used for the state that the property is in, or mortgage brokers could be from anywhere?
Well, let me attack the first question. I'll let Frank talk about the second question about mortgage brokers and their location. I'm really down on properties that have negative cash flows. If you're going to get involved in a property, unless you have the property severely under-rented and you can dramatically increase rents, I think it's very, very difficult. So I'm really negative on going into something that immediately generates a negative cash flow. Now, some people would argue on an after-tax basis that they have a positive cash flow, but that depends upon your tax bracket. So you've got to buy that property right. Remember, when you're buying real estate, you make your money on the buy side of the equation. If you buy the property right, it will take care of itself. If you pay too much for the property, then about the only thing that can bail you out is time. And time can be very, very slow under those circumstances and very, very painful. Also, it concerns me a little bit if you're going to be an absentee landlord. California is a long way away from where you're located. And unless you have someone who is very cognizant, very, very sharp in rental properties and has great management, one of the keys to success in rental property is great management. It's certainly almost as important as the buy side of the equation. So I'm concerned about negative cash flow. I'm concerned about geographical location. I'm concerned about absentee management. So you would have to convince me that you have good answers to all of those issues. Now, Frank, as far as, okay, I'm going to buy a property out of state, should I use someone locally in that geographic area, or does it matter?
Well, if you're talking about mortgage brokers, in order for a broker to do it in a particular state, they have to be licensed in that state. So, for example, you work with a mortgage broker in Illinois and you want to buy a property in California, that mortgage broker has to be licensed in California. Most states have licensing requirements. Now, in terms of better to work with, if that is the case, I'd work with a mortgage broker here locally because you know the person and he knows what your needs are, and he might be able to help you if he's licensed in that state. That being said, there's also a lot of good mortgage brokers in California and other states as well. If there is not such a person that is licensed in that state, so
Thank you.
Sure. All right, thank you. To another caller. This is Champagne, and it's line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
My name is Sean Lampkins. I'm calling. I'm a graduate student at the University of Illinois, and I just was curious about, you know, investing in, mutual funds. Just didn't know. I didn't know if anyone there would have any advice to offer about that kind of thing, but I should be in school for another 3 or 4 years. And was just curious about what I should be looking to invest in as a graduate student on a basically $20,000 budget.
Okay, let me react to that question, and maybe, Frank, you want to react to it as well. I always believe that there's no time like the present to invest, all right? You can never start investing too early. On the other hand, as a graduate student on a budget, before you start investing for the long term, you've got to have your short-term bases covered, which means that you shouldn't have large credit card bills at these exorbitant interest rates. So if you have credit card bills and exorbitant interest rates on those credit card bills, pay the credit card bills off with any excess cash. You can't even get a tax deduction for the exorbitant interest that you are paying on those credit cards. You need to have a reserve, all right? And it seems to me that you need to have cash on hand in a money market account, in a savings account, in a local bank checking account, some type of interest-bearing account of at least 6 months of expenses. All right? Now, if you have those bases covered, if you don't have any other exorbitant debts at high interest rates, then you can think about investing. And certainly mutual funds is one method of investing for diversification. There are literally thousands and thousands of different kinds of mutual funds. Some mutual funds invest in stocks. Some mutual funds invest in fixed income. Some do both. So you've got to do some research before you start investing. So I would suggest, for example, that you pick up the S&P Guide to Money and Investing at your local bookstore. It's about an $11 book. It'll take you about an hour and a half to read it. It will tell you about financial markets. It will tell you about mutual funds, investing in stocks, bonds, and securities. If you are going to invest in the stock market, in the equity markets, probably with $20,000, the best way to do that is through mutual funds because you can build some diversification, and you've got to be a long-term investor. You can't go in for 2 or 3 years and think you're going to get a big hit in the market and make a lot of money. Indeed, over the next 2 or 3 years, maybe the markets are negative. No one has that crystal ball. Stock market investing is a long-term proposition. You've got to be looking at a 15 to 20-year minimum time horizon. If you're not, you don't belong in the stock market. So do some research. You're a graduate student. Obviously, you're bright. And do some reading first before you do some investing. If you have high interest rate debt, pay that off first with any liquid cash that you have. Frank, anything you want to add?
No, I agree exactly what you said, that you're in it for the long run. That's the important thing to remember. It's the long run.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps. If the caller would like to call back and ask some more questions, he certainly may. We'll go on, though, to another person here holding on, and they are calling from Morton Grove. It's our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. Good morning, Dave and your guest.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to ask you a question. Would this be a good time to consider a second, I guess you would call it a summer home, not necessarily for rental purposes, but for primarily personal use, given the things that are going on in the mortgage market right now?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I played hooky this summer, and Kevin Waspy filled in for me with David Inge and did just a tremendous job. And one great thing about Kevin is you cover things that I don't generally cover, so it's some very, very nice diversification. And while I was playing hooky, I spent a lot of time in northern Wisconsin. And let me tell you, if there are 1,800 homes on the market in the Champaign-Urbana area, there must be 18,000 in northern Wisconsin. And they are beautiful, beautiful homes, and they are not selling. And it is clearly a buyer's market there, and I'm guessing it's the same thing in Naples, Florida, and a whole lot of other areas around the country. And maybe it's going to get worse, maybe it's not, but you certainly shouldn't feel bad about finding a realtor and lowballing offers on summer homes. I think there probably are some good buys, and there will continue to be some good buys. So if you were contemplating a second home for yourself and you knew an area that you wanted to talk about and you were interested in and you had researched, clearly those prices are dramatically lower than they were a year or 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And no one has a crystal ball, but might very well be lower because of the general economy in Michigan and the poor folks who are affected by that.
Absolutely. If you're looking in Michigan, there's no question. I mean, let's face it, the automobile industry in Michigan has been decimated, not only the majors, but all of the tertiary companies that have been involved. And that has even impacted all the way to Rantoul, Illinois, and the auto parts businesses in Rantoul, Illinois have been impacted by Detroit, as we all know. So if you're looking in Michigan, things are bleak, and certainly prices are clearly down in a lot of those investment and second home properties, and they may go lower. No one has a crystal ball, but no one's going to get in at the bottom, all right?
No.
That's just pure luck. No one knows where the bottom of the stock market is. I was talking to Frank on the way over when the market was up 300 points earlier today. I said, well, what do you think? Have we seen a bottom? And then now it was up 150, and I haven't seen it in the last 15 minutes. No one knows, but clearly you're doing some right thinking here.
That's right.
We're approaching something closer to a bottom than a top. And so you should start doing some serious looking. And if you find something you really like, don't be embarrassed. And find a realtor who won't be embarrassed by providing low-ball offers.
Definitely.
Okay, and I'm sorry, but could you repeat the name of that book that you just referenced that might be helpful?
Well, I require as reading in any of my finance classes, it's a very, very simple read, but very, very well written and just good bedside reading. It's called The S&P Guide to Money and Investing. You can pick it up in any bookstore. It's about 150, 160 pages. I think it's about between $11 and $14.
Okay.
To buy the book.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you for the help.
Yeah,
right,
pleasure.
Thank you.
Sure.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. David Sinnoh is with us. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. And once a month, always on a Friday, he's here and we talk about investing and money management. Also, he brought along as a guest Frank Balin from Revere Mortgage Company here with offices in Champaign-Urbana and Chicago to give him an opportunity to talk a little bit about the subprime lending crisis that's going on now and affecting a lot of financial markets here in this country. In fact, around the world, it's had an effect. And if you have questions about that, but also more general kinds of questions about financial planning, that's why we do these shows on a regular basis, to give you the chance to call and ask some questions. And I know Dave will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign and line one.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for a great program. I wanted to just follow up on an earlier caller, although I must just apologize. I'm just back from the dentist, so I might be a little bit less audible than usual. I'm keen to get a comment on a prudent investment strategy. Given the current turmoil in the money markets versus the real estate markets in California for rental income, if your callers could comment just generally in terms of investment strategies. I have a chunk of change. I want to put it either in a money market or in a real estate rental income market. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Well, it's certainly two very, very different kinds of markets. Money market rates have hung in there. You really haven't been hurt this year by being in the money markets. As it turns out, this year, obviously, they've outperformed the stock markets. Money markets in these national money market accounts are all above 5%. Short-term CDs, you can shop them even locally. They're in the 5% range as well. But that's a very, very safe, clean type of investment. And obviously, people who have been in that investment this year have felt pretty comfortable. Being in the rental market, it's a whole different business. So we're talking about diversification here and what is appropriate diversification. And what the caller is really asking is, what percentage of the portfolio do I feel comfortable with being in the real estate market? I can't choose your rental property for you. I know that rental properties today, interestingly enough, in the rental side of the market, if you're looking at apartment buildings, they really haven't dropped a whole lot in value. In fact, a lot of people who no longer can afford houses, who have been bought really out of the housing market because they can't afford to borrow, are now back in the rental market. And indeed, rentals have actually increased slightly, as far as I understand it, Frank. Is that your understanding?
That is correct.
So if we're going to have more rental income as a result of having it more difficult to procure a loan, then rental housing might make some sense. But we're talking about multifamily housing. California multifamily housing, hey, I'm not an expert. You'd have to really dig in, understand what's going on. Maybe the caller is. Maybe the caller has friends out there who understand that market. But clearly, that's a much more sophisticated, volatile market, and I really can't make any comments about it other than rents in general have trended up. That's even true in the Chicago area.
That's correct.
So I don't know. Do you want to add anything to
that?
No,
I think that's correct. It is. Again, that's just what happens. If you can't afford a house, then you are going to have to live somewhere, and usually that is an apartment. So I would agree. Multifamily has gone up.
So the real issue then is what percentage of my overall investment portfolio should be in real estate? And that's a different answer for different people. It might be 10% for a lot of folks. Even in our couch potato portfolio, even if you own your own residential home, I really have about somewhere between 5 and 7% in the real estate market. And I'm investing through real estate investment trusts, which, of course, have been hammered this year, but have had a wonderful run over the last 5 years. For other people who feel very comfortable in real estate and realize that it is a long-term investment, feel very comfortable, a much larger percentage of their portfolio may be devoted. So this is an individual type of decision. But just again, you've got to buy the property right, and you really need wonderful management. Management is such a key to rental property.
Okay. I hope that helps. Let's go next. We'll talk with someone in Belgium over by Danville, line number two. Hello.
Yes. I hope I can make this articulate enough to make my point. If I understand this right, these subprime loans are pretty much like what we see at Ditech and stuff like that on TV, where they've advertised a great deal, said, please come and borrow some money from us, and we'll let you in at a low rate, and then later on we're going to raise your rate for you and go on with your home ownership like that, and you're going to get it off your increased value of your house. And now the people who invest in Ditech or whoever it might be want to make more money off the money that they have in their pocket or invested, so they take the risk of being involved with these people. And now these people are not doing so well because of various reasons, and people are not being able to make the payments or whatever, however you want to look at it. So these people are not getting the return on their investment that they really would like. And some of these people are large banks in Europe and United States. And so to keep those banks from having trouble because they took too much risk, countries are printing money to give to them, which is in turn going to turn around and inflate all of our livelihoods. So for somebody to take risk, all of us are going to have to pay. Seems to me that's not really the way it's supposed to work, is it?
Well, let's start back at the beginning with these companies like a Ditech that you see on television. Aren't they, first of all, advertising conventional mortgage financing?
Yes.
So they're not really into the subprime financing because they're simply a mortgage broker and they're not in that business. But clearly, let's go beyond the issue of Ditech. Ditech is really like anyone else. It's not that much unlike Revere, except they're a national mortgage lending organization, which is obviously saying, come to me.
Right.
All right. So let's go on and say, well, are we essentially bailing out folks? Is that what's really happening here? That's the point of the caller, that, okay, some people said, gee, we're going to be greedy. We want to make the 9, 10, 11%. So we're going to extend this credit to subprime lenders under the theory that they're going to make their loans. So we're going to eat into the 9%, and we're not happy with 5, 6, 7%. And suddenly these folks can't make these payments. So I'm a hedge fund. I've bought a lot of this paper. I'm sitting out here with 9, 10, 11% paper that people aren't making their loans. And the gentleman is saying, well, here's what's happening. The Fed is reducing interest rates, making credit easier so these people can access credit, et cetera. So aren't we, in a sense, bailing all of these folks out?
Well, let's keep in mind that these hedge funds are being bailed out not by the government. They're being bailed out by private capital. And so that's not the government bailing them out in that respect. Now, as far as the money going into to dropping interest rate and making credit easier, mostly that's for to show confidence and easing the credit crisis for good borrowers. There's not a direct relation to that in an inflation at all.
I think that the major point is that for people who are holding this paper, the government isn't bailing them out. We've got to find private investors who are going to come in and take additional risk, recapitalize the portfolio, and to the extent the portfolio recovers, these new recapitalized lenders are going to reap the benefits.
That's correct.
Okay. And by lowering interest rates in the economy in general, it essentially should transfer into lower borrowing rates for good borrowers, which means that there will be a larger body of borrowers who can now borrow money, which should help the housing market in general.
That's right.
Okay. So I hope we've straightened that out just a bit.
Well, may I ask a comment here? Didn't I understand last week that Spain and the Netherlands and several countries over there infused a great deal of cash into some of these banks there that were involved in these very same things?
I don't know yet.
Well, that may well be the case, but I think when they infuse the capital into these institutions, just like we infuse capital into U.S. institutions, that's got to be paid back. It's just not free money. Now, I can't tell you how Spain handles it, et cetera, so I'm not an expert in that area. But generally, when the Fed infuses capital, it's borrowed capital.
That is right.
You know, so it has to be paid back. I can't tell you how it works in these other countries.
Yeah, because they were talking about putting billions of euros into these banks, and that's a lot of money to be paying back.
Yeah, it is. It clearly is.
They didn't even say anything like about talking back. It just sounded like it was more and more about printing money to me. But
well,
maybe I misunderstood it.
Well, when governments usually infuse money into financial institutions, generally it is loaned to those financial institutions.
It's not given.
Okay? That at least is the theory.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Let's get one more caller at least. This is Champagne in line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I called for a different reason, but it had to do with the packaging, didn't it? What happened is that in terms of these loans, that there was good paper and there's bad paper, and the problem is that they don't know which is which. Isn't that part of the issue?
Well, Frank, I'll defer to you on this.
If you're talking about package loans, it depends on where they're packaging. If they're packaging them for Fannie and Freddie, all those loans have to meet certain government guidelines, Fannie Mae guidelines. So they just can't package any paper. So they have certain credit guidelines, income guidelines, and that's all put together, packaged together into hundreds of millions of dollars worth of packages and sent in to Fannie or Freddie.
Right, but I mean, in terms of this, we're talking about this crisis. It was that they put in some of the good loans with the bad ones for these independent investors, from my understanding.
Well, again, if 15% of subprime loans are in default, you've got good loans and bad loans.
That's
but
right.
Again, these are not conventional loans, because the conventional loans, as you point out, still meet pretty strict guidelines in terms of credit, in terms of tax returns, in terms of appraisals, et cetera.
Yeah.
The subprimes were a lot more freewheeling. So you obviously have good ones and you have bad ones that were packaged together.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, even as you said, over the next 12 to 18 months, there may be some more unfolding that we don't even know how many bad ones are out there.
Right.
I'm just checking in terms of misinformation. A crisis in terms of credit card, I heard a figure of something like $75 billion in terms of bad debt. And, one of the growth industries now is collection agencies where, they get, 10 cents on a dollar or some or other. And I can see why the credit companies turn it over. They have high interest, so they're making a lot of money anyway. But they can actually write it off. But $75 billion, seems like a big figure to me.
Well, $75 billion is a big number, although when you think about the GDP of the country and you're talking, $15 trillion compared to $75 billion, it's sort of a drop in the bucket. But to you and me, I agree. You're talking some real money here, $75 billion.
Well, they're also talking about the average, $9,000 is the average?
Family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's a little high. The last I saw was something like 4,800, but you may have updated numbers.
Okay.
But still, it's still a ridiculous number that you'd be paying 15 to 20% interest on. It's just crazy.
A problem in this industry, too. I mean, people are way over, too much credit. But anyway, good program.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish up. As some last thought that you'd like to leave folks with this morning?
Well, I guess with this dearth of housing on the markets and more housing is on the market and it's not selling, it does spill over because that means less refrigerators, less stoves, less lumber being sold, et cetera. And that does have a spillover impact and affects corporate profits. And that will have a debilitating impact on stocks as well. So that's part of the spillover effect of this subprime mortgage business.
Well, just let me ask you one other question. I think you talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but I just wanted to underscore this. Will this mean that for people who have good credit and would be able to qualify for a conventional loan are going to have difficulty getting their loan? Is this going to make, make it more difficult for everyone to get credit?
How should I put this? People have good credit and have sufficient income qualification stuff. It really shouldn't be much harder at all, really. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say it's about business as usual. Now, when we talk about something we didn't talk about today, jumbo mortgage lending, which is not Fannie and Freddie, but it's an whole area we didn't discuss, those are guidelines are tightening a lot. But traditional people getting something under $417,000 to qualify, you will not really notice anything. And really, rates are still extremely good when you think about it. Rates in the sixes, it's hard to complain about interest rates. So it shouldn't help people that have sufficient income and credit to be able to qualify for a mortgage in general.
All right. Well, okay. I guess we're going to have to leave it at that with our thanks to David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month, he's here on the show on Friday, and we'll see you again next month.
It's to do this. Been fun today.
Great. And also Frank Balin from Revere Mortgage Company in Champaign-Urbana and Chicago along here as a special guest. Thanks.
Well, thank you.